Hello, and thank you for tuning in to Voices from Room. On this podcast, writers, poets, activists, artists, and analysts who have contributed to Room talk about their work, themselves, and the complex problems our world faces. Room is currently open for submissions until May 5th, 2024. To submit your work and to read more, visit us online at analytic-room.com. My name is Isaac Sloan, and I'm joined by Aneta Stojnic. Hi, Aneta.
Hi, Isaac, and everyone who's listening. It is my great pleasure to welcome our guest today, Dr. Danielle Benvenisti, who is a clinical psychologist in the Seattle area in Washington State and a visiting professor of clinical psychology at the Wuhan Mental Health Center in the People's Republic of China. He is the author of The Interwoven Lives of Sigmund Anna and Ernst Freud, Three Generations of Psychoanalysis, and is an honorary member of the American Psychoanalytic Association. And he published two pieces in Room so far that are the immediate cause for this conversation today. One is National Histories and Identity, which was published in 2019. And the other piece from 2020, Diving into the Stream. And both of these, in both of these pieces, you go into your experience of living in Venezuela, and are connecting your experience of living in Venezuela with the present moment at a time when you're writing. It was a time when Trump was president. And we are now having this conversation in the new election year when Trump is running again. So first of all, welcome, and maybe we can really start our conversation from there. How is this experience shaping your political thinking?
I think that's the word, shaping political thinking. To begin with, I would say that I'm very interested in the relationship between psychology and history. And it's something that I was interested in even before I went to Venezuela for 11 years. My father was a Cold War warrior involved in defense research. We had a air raid bomb shelter or a siren at the corner of the street when I was just a boy. We were instructed in school how to duck and cover in the event of a nuclear attack. It was extraordinarily present, the possibility of a nuclear holocaust in the late 50s, early 60s. Then by the time I was a teenager, I was very aware and caught up in trying to see my way through not only the possibility of being drafted into Vietnam, but also sort of swimming in the counterculture and all of the ways in which my generation was being swept up in alternative ways of participating in the world personally and politically. And so it went throughout my adulthood. And yes, when I went to Venezuela, it became apparent very quickly that Hugo Chavez was not a great leftist leader like he liked to present himself as, but rather as a authoritarian leader who wanted to impose his will upon the people. And at first, I was staying back and not involving myself. I was a foreigner in a foreign land or in their land. But when I watched a 17-year-old girl die on television from a gunshot wound from a Chavista, I said to myself, I can't remain quiet. I was writing articles on the psychology of everyday life for the English language newspaper. And soon when there was a big sort of a kind of a slaughter. 19 people were killed, 100 people were shot up by the government. I was in that march. I didn't see the gunfire. When that happened, I said, got to do something. So what did I do? I wrote an article for my column in the newspaper on the authoritarian personality, which is something that psychoanalysts and other psychologists had been working on back in the 40s and published in 1950. Okay. So I was watching and involved in that whole drama in Venezuela. I was trying to offer my two cents to the Venezuelan opposition. I can't honestly say they listened, but I had plenty of contact and published some articles and things like this. But then the country was just melting down. And in 2010, my wife and I moved to the United States, and we were happy to be here. When Trump came to power, it was just like deja vu. It was just all over again. And some of my first bits of political action were articles about the similarity between Chavez and Trump.
You know, I really appreciated reading your article as a foreigner to some degree in this country. I really appreciated reading your article, The Foreigner's Dilemma, that you express at the beginning, where at first you felt like it wasn't your place to get involved because you were a foreigner. And then you were compelled to act. And I'm wondering if you could say maybe a little bit more about that dilemma. I think it's a particular feeling that I find relatable, but maybe not many people do.
Before I went to Venezuela, my father told me, he says, listen, don't forget, you are a guest.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, don't get involved in politics. This was before anything was even happening. And I agreed with him. I thought that made perfect sense. I hadn't been so involved in U.S. politics for quite some time, other than voting and whatnot. But it was after I saw one thing after another that I began thinking a line was crossed, and I could no longer be quiet. And I tried to keep a low profile. I often published under a pseudonym. I went to Chavista marches frequently. I would go and I would videotape them. I have all sorts of videos of the Chavista marches and Chavez droning on for hours. But I also went to the opposition marches. And when I say I went to the marches, there were dozens of them. They were happening all the time. And they would, you know, flood the freeways. That's the way they would do it there. There wasn't a very circumscribed route, typically. They would just flood the freeways. So I was in one, there was literally 1.4 million people in the street. Yes, it was when I watched this. There's a video of a 17-year-old girl who was in a march or a demonstration, and Chavista came. Chavista is the person that supports Chavez, came in shooting up people, and he killed an old woman, a middle-aged man, and a bullet to the head of this 17-year-old girl. And I said, enough's enough. I have to do something.
Well, what you said about how something about the totalitarian government and what Chavez meant became apparent to you is something that you take up in your writing. It's a moment of waking up to the realities of what's happening around you in society and government. It feels somewhat linked to psychoanalysis, being awoken to or facing and confronting something that otherwise just goes on around you. In your writing, you say, Totalitarian governments oppress the psychoanalytic enterprise whenever they move to silence people. They are threatened by the subversive nature of psychoanalysis. Can you speak more to both the subversive nature of psychoanalysis and how it plays a role in our becoming aware of the realities of the world we live in, as well as our role in it?
The first thing I would say is there's no such thing as free association in a world that doesn't have freedom of speech. So as soon as there's no freedom of speech, you know, you cannot free associate. This became an issue in Venezuela when they said, there was a law they were floating that if you hear someone saying anything against the government, you need to report them. Well, there it was. You know, you could no longer go to your analyst at that point. It was the law was floated. It was struck down. But the totalitarian message got through. This was not going to be business as usual, and people have to watch themselves. Beyond that, I think the subversive nature of psychoanalysis has, sometimes people reference it, but I feel like by and large, it's been lost. It's been forgotten. There's much more about adjustment and mourning old losses. But I think what psychoanalysis helps us to do is see the underbelly of our wishes, who we think we are. So we might say, well, I am a good, righteous person. And then in analysis, we might discover, yes, I am a good, righteous person, but I have a hope that I'm going to get some goodies out of it. There are selfish interests under our loftiest goals. Sometimes people put themselves out as suffering souls, and they discover on the other side that it's a control mechanism. Sometimes people present themselves as being very erotic and lively, and the underside is it's an expression of hostility. People that will be, you know, angry bullies, they discover there's a vulnerable fear underneath it. So when you recognize that psychoanalysis is taking off the cap to our own personal self-reputation, if you will, it's a discovery of what motivates me. What do I want? Which is very different from how I present myself to the world. So, and of course, many people confuse how they present themselves to the world with who they are. In psychoanalysis, you get a chance to say, well, this is how I present myself to the world, and I like that. But I can now see my selfish interests, my fears and anxieties, my old hurts, are getting expressed in this persona I have developed. Mm-hmm. So when you begin to see the rise of authoritarian leaders, look at how people respond to it. Some people respond in just absolute horror. They say, what is this? What are we doing here? And other people say, aha, now, here's a guy that's strong. It's usually a guy. Here's a guy that's strong, and I'm with him. I'm going to identify with the aggressor. We know for, you know, over a half century that that's not the dynamics of an authoritarian. This is authoritarianism a very, very human condition. I would dare say it is the most basic of cultural organization. This is where we are. I'm very interested in primatology. We have, what is it, 98.6%. We share 98.6% of our DNA with chimpanzees. Chimpanzees have a system organized around alpha males. We think, oh, that's interesting, those chimpanzees over there. Humans have been doing that, organizing their social groups around alpha males for thousands of years, and they continue to in kings and sheikhs and czars and what we call in Latin America, caudillos, strongman politics. Mm-hmm. What is democracy? Democracy is when we say, yes, we want a strong leader, but it's not going to be this person over here. It's going to be a set of institutions and laws. That's a whole new thing. That's a whole new thing in the world.
I just want to point out, because it's a really, really important point that you're making here, because you're really saying that democracy is a developmental achievement. Our capacity to participate in democratic processes is a developmental achievement.
And a fragile achievement. Mm. It's one that we can achieve and lose. And what are we always going to lose it to? We're always going to lose it to the authoritarians. You see, that's just sort of how where we slide back down. Mm. And so when we think about the psychology behind authoritarian rule, this is where I go with it. If you look at them, people say, oh, it looks like Trump has been studying the works of Adolf Hitler. I don't think Trump reads. And you don't need to read to become an authoritarian. You just have to climb into your own selfish, brutish self. And there it is. You just become a bully. They don't have classes on how to become a bully. It just comes out. You have to have classes to learn how to not be a bully.
Yeah, and it pulls on to the most primitive aspects in other people and in society. That's why the regression happens. Yeah.
Exactly. And so that's when we have to recognize that it's not the authoritarian personality is not just the authoritarian. It's mm-hmm. all the people that say, hey, cool, that's what we want. You know, mm-hmm. that looks good to me. I feel inadequate in my life. And now I can participate in the narcissism mm-hmm. of the authoritarian leader. We're together.
You're now mentioning narcissism, and one, I think, extremely important point that you're making in your one of the articles has to do with when you're asked to provide a diagnosis, like you speak about, like when you were in Venezuela, and you know, people would ask you, well, kind of like, what is Chavez's diagnosis? And we had like these many discussions about Trump's diagnosis, and those discussions here with kind of like pro and cons within the profession, as we know, went from like what is an ethical thing to do? Can one ethically diagnose somebody who has not been their patient or not? But you take a different route in this thinking, which is really important. You say that diagnosis cannot be used as an accusation and as a pejorative. And I find that you say there should never be anything disqualifying about a diagnosis. And you give examples how name-calling, using diagnosis as name-calling, really empties it from any kind of meaning and prevents us from thinking about deeper aspect of what is behind that name. So maybe you can say a bit more about that.
Yes, you know, I have to begin by saying, you know, there was this famous book, which now is in its second edition, of the case of Donald J. Trump, in which all sorts of distinguished people in mental health wrote, including one of the giants, Robert J. Lifton. So I'm reluctant to say it shouldn't be done, because there are so many people who are really good, and I think they do it out of a good intentions. But you know, if you look at that, just look at that book, they come up with probably 10 different diagnoses, which in itself tells us something. If we say he is a malignant narcissist, it becomes an insult. That's what that is. I'd prefer to say he's a liar. I'd prefer to say, you know, he's a sexist pig. I'd prefer to say he's bringing a Muslim ban to a country that was founded on religious freedom. I feel like that's a language that it's political language, and it's a language that political people or people can understand. To come up with a diagnosis, I feel like it is a little bit of a distraction. So when people, yes, I would be giving a lecture on parenting strategies at a school in Venezuela, and they said, "Well, as long as we got you here, what do you think of Chavez?" And I said, "Pay attention to what he's doing, not what some psychologist thinks is his diagnosis. What do you do with the diagnosis? What mental health professionals will do with it is different from what the public will do with it." And meanwhile, I say, let's keep our sights on the action.
I'm thinking about your point at the end of one of your essays. In remembering rather than repeating, we are able to act politically rather than frozen in neurotic fear. I think that has relevance here too. How do we understand someone like Trump or Chavez? And as we head into an election year, I'm already finding myself in situations in which I or the group enter states of neurotic fear. I'm interested in this idea of remembering and thinking about when that fails and when that's hard to do.
You know, Chavez is like about, I think he's about three or f was three or 4 years, 3 or 4 months younger than I am. There were, I saw him all the time in the street, live and in person. We saw him on television. He was droning on and on in the radio constantly. But there were times when I would see him on television and I would be terrified. The way he was talking, I would just be terrified. And I'd say, what the heck is happening here? Because something is getting transmitted. And it was reawakened with the whole Trump disaster. And I said, who is the authoritarian for me? And you know, I began to think about old hurts, and I began to think about, but as I went back further and further until I got to, we have all met the authoritarian. It's called mom. It's the world of the infant that is helpless. It's mom and dad and siblings and all of the people that decide our fate when our very psyche is so fragile. And you know, you can have the most empathic and warm and sweet mommy, you know, but there are still panics that the infant goes through. And I think the authoritarian tears all of us back to that. But beyond that, it gets elaborated in little experiences. I call them little experiences. They're big experience for a kid in nursery school, of the bully, or of in elementary school or junior high or high school, or the teacher, or the this one or that one, or parents. And so when I listen to people's political grief, I'm always listening to find out where it hooks them personally in their own personal history. If you've got 10 people that you know, hate Trump, they will all hate him in different ways. I always say, you know, when 10 people watch the Super Bowl, they all watch 10 different games because they're paying attention in a different way. And so we want to ask ourselves, how is this patient looking at this? Mm-hmm. Recently, I had one patient in one session who was Palestinian, another patient in another session who's Israeli, and they're distressed by what's going on. It's very easy as a therapist to be able to empathize with suffering and hurt and all the rest. So that's where I am. But then I want to listen for how it's touching them. And we make our way right back into, well, this happened in my family. Oh, this happened in my family. Oh, we talked about that before in another context. Yes, it's being reawakened. So we want to, I fear that so many people in psychoanalysis are getting seduced by reality and thinking that they are going to involve themselves with reality at the level of the real or at the level of the political, which is fine for psychoanalysts to be involved as citizens or even citizens of the world to take political action. That's great. But what's it touching inside each individual? What's being awakened? Mm-hmm. And if you listen closely, you begin to hear something that's happening at the macro level. You know, you're watching on TV, or God forbid, it's happening all around you, but it's touching you in a very, very personal way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when people, quite frequently, when people talk about the horror of racism, if you follow it, it might go all the way back to a sibling rivalry. Now, by the way, just because you can trace it back there does not invalidate your political position. I'm always very careful to explain that, you know, when I'm talking with my patients. Just because you can trace your horror of the political situation back to your childhood doesn't mean you say, oh, yeah, well, here I go again with, you know, the way my, you know, my dad spanked me or something like that. That does not invalidate your political position. Mm-hmm. But what it does do is it gives you self-knowledge so that you can be more effective in your political activity rather than acting out.
I'm really glad that you made that distinction, like that it does not, the tracing back and going into the psychic reality does not invalidate the political position. And I'm also hearing that you're touching upon another very interesting concept from your article when you write about the political countertransference. And I was wondering if you could say a bit more about that.
Well, I guess it's just simply that whole point that while the patient is talking, they're talking about a hot button that quite likely is touching me. You know, I'm someone that does watch the news. I'm someone that does read what's going on. And so I might have some very strong opinions about it. And I think it's useful to have those strong opinions, but not have them bleed out. You know, that would be the counter transference to it. If the patient says, oh, what do you think about what's going on in the Middle East? Well, that's not what I'm here for. But it's going to awaken thoughts and feelings I have about it. And I'm going to want to create a space for the patient to talk about their, number one, their feelings, and two, where they come from. And so we want to be able to keep out of the way, keep our political thoughts out of the way of the patient. This was something, I never ever talked about politics with my patients until I was in Venezuela, and I had a guy from the embassy. I think he was a military guy, and he just looked at me and he says, "What do you think about Chavez?" And I thought, he's either a spy coming to find out who I am, or he's worried about speaking up. And so I was very open and very clear, saying, "Well, I think he's an authoritarian leader, and I don't support him at all." And then he was able to talk. Similarly, I'm here in the Pacific Northwest, right in the heart of a high-tech hub of the world. We have Amazon and Microsoft and Expedia and 100 other high-tech companies here. Most of my patients are immigrants. Many of them are from hotspots. And when topics come up, I need to be able to listen, be curious, and hear about their story without imposing mine. It's just like with psychoanalysis. If you have a patient that's talking about their sexuality, and you have your own conflicts or old hurts or frustrations, you don't want those to bleed into the analysis or the therapy. Similarly, you don't want your political views to invade. That said, when I have Muslim patients or Mexican patients, and I'm a white man in a country with we did have, a white president that said, Mexicans are rapists, and we're going to ban Muslims. I was, some people might disagree with my approach, but I was clear about how I didn't agree with that. I was clear with my patients. Beyond that, I wanted to open it up and let them talk.
Well, I think an element of that is just how rupturing and destabilizing and invasive so many of these political moments have been. And how, as you say, people have early experiences and present day experiences of being violated, interrupted, ruptured. How do we contend with that in our working with each other or in the analytic space? There needs to be enough of a solid foundation with the idea that, of course, there are interruptions and ruptures in an analytic encounter.
A patient of mine who is Muslim was driving down the road, and the other car in the other lane held up his hand, like a gun, and did this little business to him. And I could sit there and say, and how did you feel? But I didn't. The first thing I did was register my horror. It's not funny. And it's sometimes the beginning of something that turns really ugly. I try not to let it in let my reaction invade, but I try to let them know they're safe to talk with me about this. Another thing that I wanted to mention is that the relationship between psychology and history. Number one, it's a fascinating topic. Number two, it's actually been around for quite a while. I think my article Diving in the Stream was an effort to not only raise the issue and invite people to speak up more, but also to let people know actually people have been quite involved in this for quite some time within psychoanalysis. That Freud wrote the introduction to the book on psychoanalysis and the war neuroses. He advocated that people work in the low-fee clinics. He wrote the paper on why war. Anna Freud and Dorothy Burlingham set up the homes for bombed out children. Siegfried Bernfeld opened an orphanage for orphans after the First World War. It was actually the inspiration for Anna Freud and Dorothy Burlingham. There's all sorts of ways in which people have been involved politically and socially. And so I think it's valuable that we remember that. The other thing that I wanted to mention is it's sort of tying back to the reference to our social instincts embedded in our primate DNA. My most recent book is called Libido, Culture, and Consciousness, Revisiting Freud's Totem and Taboo. And it's about revisiting Freud's famous book, Totem and Taboo, only he made a couple of errors that in that book that had psychoanalysts avoiding it for the next 100 years. But I think the book is absolutely brilliant, even with all the errors in it. And so I went back to develop those, offer my correction to those errors, and then follow the development of culture from the Paleolithic to the Neolithic, to the High Neolithic, to the Urban Revolution, the beginning large-scale civilizations. And in that, you can see this rather remarkable dance going on between the development, the development of the child and the development of culture, and how the oral demands of the infant are sort of projected into the construction of the issues of Paleolithic culture. So it's a broader topic for another day, but and how the anal issues are awakened in the Neolithic, and the Oedipal issues get awakened in the High Neolithic, and how the issues of adolescence and the genital stage are awakened in the development of the earliest civilizations of the Urban Revolution. The whole point here, though, is that there is this dance going on. There's a dance between the individual and the group in creating culture, in assisting the evolution of culture. And now, as we are here at this level in cultural development, looking at how our psychology is shaped by and shaping history.
Thank you for sharing that with us. It sounds like a very, very rich topic, and I would certainly be looking forward to reading it. And like something that really kind of like transpires both through this conversation and through your writing is how you seem to really see writing as a way of doing a political action, or as an important way to engage and to do political action. And maybe for the end, you might want to say a few words about that, about the relationship between writing and or writing as a political action.
One of the things that I say to people who are looking at the news and finding themselves absolutely overwhelmed by what's happening in the Ukraine, or what's happening in Gaza and Israel, and what's happening in Iran and whatnot, in China, I say stay informed. But if you're overwhelmed, turn off the news and do something. Write a letter. Go to a march. Talk to a friend. Mobilize that anxiety into something that is pro-social. And for me, one of the things that I have been that I have done is to write. And I don't really worry so much about how far my writing goes. I know that most of the time it probably doesn't get much further than my computer, or maybe even it gets into a website and may die a quiet death there. But I've said what I had to say. And, you know, one of the things that there was a guy named Yehuda Bauer, and he said the three commandments of the Holocaust are, thou shalt not be a victim, thou shalt not be a perpetrator, and thou shalt not be a bystander. That means a lot to me. I may not be able to change history in Venezuela or the United States or anywhere else, but I will not be a bystander. And I encourage everyone to, you know, instead of getting together with their friends and grousing about the world, do something with it. You know, in that beautiful book, beautiful essay of Freud's on why war, he says, well, I don't know why you ask an unworldly theorist to weigh in on the issue of war. In such a situation, you have to get whatever weapons are close at hand. But anything that fosters the bonds between people works against war. That to me is just a beautiful, beautiful feeling. And it's often given me solace. Anything that fosters the bonds between people works against war. So that's writing, that's visiting, that's talking, that's taking care of your family, that's taking care of your patients, that's being with your friends, bringing culture back to your life and the world. And of course, again, another great line from Martin Luther King, silence is betrayal. You see, just, I think we need these little statements to help us get oriented to what's important and to recognize that, yes, we can have a role in this world. It might be a small one. You know, I can't say I changed history in Venezuela. I sure tried. Nor in this country. But I've not been silent, and I've not been a bystander.
Thank you very much for speaking with us today and for sharing your rich experience with our listeners.
Well, thank you, and thanks to Room, because you obviously are offering a very important avenue for people to make their words count. And I appreciate that very much. Muchísimas gracias.
Thanks so much.
Okay.